Good afternoon, and thank you all for standing by. For the duration of today's conference, all participants' lines are on a listen-only mode until the question and answer session. At that time, if you would like to ask a question, press star one. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. It is my pleasure to introduce Mr. Paul Fulton. Thank you, sir. You may begin.
Thank you. Thank you all for joining us today for this briefing to update you on CDC's COVID-19 response. Today, we are joined by Acting Assistant Secretary for Consular Affairs for the Department of State, Ian G. Brownlee, and Dr. Nancy Messonnier, Director of CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, who will give opening remarks before taking your questions. At this time, I will turn the call over to Acting Assistant Secretary for Consular Affairs, Brownlee.
Good morning. I'd like to say a word about the cruise ship travel alert that the State Department posted yesterday afternoon. The U.S. Department of State has no higher priority than the safety and welfare of U.S. citizens overseas. On February 20th, the Department advised all U.S. citizens to reconsider travel by cruise ship to or within Asia. Many countries have implemented strict screening procedures to prevent the spread of the COVID-19 virus. This is a dynamic situation, and U.S. citizens traveling by ship may be impacted by travel restrictions affecting their itineraries or may be subject to quarantine procedures implemented by local authorities. While the U.S. government has successfully evacuated hundreds of our citizens in recent weeks, such repatriation flights do not reflect our standard practice and should not be relied upon as an option for U.S. citizens under potential risk of quarantine by local authorities. We urge U.S. citizens to evaluate the risks associated with choosing to remain in an area that may be subject to quarantine and to take all appropriate proactive measures. People who plan to travel by cruise ship should contact their cruise ship line companies for further information on the current rules and restrictions and should continue to monitor the travel.state.gov website for updated information. We encourage all U.S. citizens traveling overseas to enroll their travel plans in the Smart Traveler Enrollment Program found at step.state.gov so they can receive important messages about their destination, including timely alerts and updates to travel advisories. Finally, you can find the full text of the travel alert on that same website, travel.state.gov. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Acting Assistant Secretary Brownlee, and thank you all for joining us today. This is Nancy Messonnier. I want to start by explaining a change in how we will be reporting our confirmed cases of COVID-19 beginning today and going forward. We are breaking our case counts into two tables. One only tracks people who were repatriated by the State Department, and the second tracks all other cases picked up through U.S. Public Health Network. CDC will continue to update these numbers every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. We are keeping track of cases resulting from repatriation efforts separately because we don't believe those numbers accurately represent the picture of what is happening in the community in the United States at this time. As of this morning, when you break things up this way, we have 13 U.S. cases versus 21 cases among people who were repatriated. The repatriated cases include 18 passengers from the Diamond Princess and 3 from the Wuhan repatriation flights. Now, I want to update you on the status of the repatriation efforts. Yesterday, nearly all of the remaining people who returned from Wuhan, China, via State Department chartered flights, who have been quarantined at 4 Department of Defense installations across the U.S., have completed their 14-day quarantine. We are truly thankful to those released from quarantine for their cooperation and patience and wish them well as they return to home, work, and school. I want to be clear that someone who has been released from quarantine is not at risk for spreading the virus to others. Specifically, they are not infected. Additionally, I want to extend my thanks to the men and women on all of the DOD bases and their families for their graciousness while hosting these guests. We are also thankful that Travis Air Force Base and Joint Base San Antonio Lackland have continued to open their doors to the recently returned passengers from the Diamond Princess cruise ship. Now for the Diamond Princess. Earlier this week, 329 U.S. citizens returned to the United States aboard 2 State Department chartered flights. So far, 18 have tested positive at CDC. Another 10 were reportedly positive in Japan. 11 are receiving care at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, 5 are receiving care around Travis, and 2 are receiving care around Lackland. Because the passengers on the Diamond Princess were in a close setting where there has been a significant spread of COVID-19, they are considered at high risk for infection, and we do not expect to see additional confirmed cases of COVID-19 among the passengers. Additionally, since many of these people are over the age of 60, we are also prepared for other medical issues to arise that will require hospitalization. We're going to do everything we can to make their quarantine as easy as possible while monitoring them to see if they develop illness. Our goal for these people who have been repatriated is to be sure that each and every person is properly cared for and that those who are in need of medical care receive it. To ensure this, we are working closely with local hospitals as well as other facilities across the country who are prepared to provide this care. I want to take a minute to extend my condolences to the families who have lost loved ones who were infected on the Diamond Princess. We heard yesterday that 2 Japanese passengers of the Diamond Princess died. There are several Americans with COVID-19 who are hospitalized in Japan and who are seriously ill. Sadly, we may see poor outcomes in others, not just people who were on board the Diamond Princess, but among others who become sick with this virus. Despite the increasing cases in China and around the world, we believe our aggressive travel precautions are working. As I said, the number of cases detected through the recent U.S. surveillance systems has increased to 13. The most recent patient was announced last night by Humboldt County in California. This was a patient who had traveled to mainland China. The fact that we have been able to keep this number low is good news, especially given what we are seeing among some countries in Asia that are beginning to experience community spread. This is when cases are detected in the community, but it's not known what the source of the infection was. This is being reported in Singapore, South Korea, Taiwan, Thailand, and Vietnam, as well as Hong Kong and Japan. The last 2 countries we issued level 1 travel notices for earlier this week. We are working in close coordination with the State Department to keep travelers informed with up-to-the-minute guidance, including on cruise ship travel, as discussed by Mr. Brownlee. We never expected that we would catch every single traveler with novel coronavirus returning from China, given the nature of this virus and how it's spreading. That would be simply impossible. I want to be clear that we're not seeing community spread here in the United States yet, but it's very possible, even likely, that it may eventually happen. Our goal continues to be slowing the introduction of the virus into the U.S. This buys us more time to prepare our communities for more cases and possibly sustained spread. This new virus represents a tremendous public health threat. We don't yet have a vaccine for this novel virus, nor do we have a medicine to treat it specifically. We are now taking and will continue to take unprecedented aggressive action to reduce the impact of this virus that it will have on the communities in the U.S. We are working with state, local, and territorial health departments to ready our public health workforce to respond to local cases and the possibility this outbreak could become a pandemic. We are working closely with healthcare systems across the country to reinforce infection control principles and plan for surges of people seeking and requiring care. We're collaborating with supply chain partners to understand what medical supplies are needed and available. This will help CDC understand when we may need to take more aggressive measures to ensure that healthcare workers on the front lines have access to the supplies that they need. We're working with businesses, hospitals, pharmacies, clinicians, manufacturers, and distributors to communicate about these measures and what they can do to get ready. I want to direct everyone to a document that will be very informative in terms of what people can expect in the coming weeks if the virus starts spreading in our community. This is an MMWR recommendations and report titled Community Mitigation Guidelines to Prevent Pandemic Influenza, United States 2017. We are reviewing all of our pandemic preparedness materials and adapting them to COVID-19. These materials will serve as a blueprint for the community interventions that we will use here in the U.S. If you're watching the news, you may be hearing about schools shutting down and businesses closing in countries in Asia to reduce the potential spread of this virus. The day may come when we will need to implement such measures in the U.S. communities. By next week, we expect to be posting a new web page focused on what CDC is already doing to mitigate transmission in communities. We recognize the uncertainty of the current situation. As always, CDC public health experts strive to make the best recommendations based on the most up-to-date data. Our guidance will change as we learn more about this virus. When that happens, we will share it with you. We'd be happy to take questions now.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please unmute your phone, press star 1, and when prompted, record your first and last name clearly so I may introduce you. To withdraw your question, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, press star 1. Our first question comes from Jason Gale with Bloomberg News. Sir, your line is open.
Thanks for taking my question. It has two parts. We've heard something like 40% of COVID-19 patients hospitalized in China have received corticosteroids. Could this be worsening the disease by impeding viral clearance or helping patients by calming a lung-damaging immune response? And I guess the second bit is, what's the worst threat, the virus or the body's response to it?
This is CDC. I would say in general that CDC clinical guidance does not recommend the use of steroids for this virus based on the information we have now. I've also seen those reports out of China, but I would consider it to be unverified at this point. And as we've talked about before, folks are rushing appropriately to get information out, but sometimes it's difficult to know which of those have been fully peer-reviewed. So I wouldn't want to comment more directly on what clinical practice is or is not in China. As many of you know, there is a Warren team on the field now in China working specifically on this outbreak, and we, like everyone else, are waiting for the reports to come out from Warren so that we can learn more about what they're finding in China. I would also point out that there is also a WHO overseen clinical group that is involving not just the U.S., but all the countries that are treating patients with this so that we can be sharing experiences and using best practices that are available across the globe. And in terms of your second question, again, I really do think it's premature to hypothesize why some patients are having poorer outcomes than others, but I would just remind us that the emerging data still says that the people who have the worst outcomes are those who are older and with underlying illnesses, and that seems to be true, continue to be true. Next question.
And our next question is from Lisa Krieger with San Jose Mercury News. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you very much. So 10 Americans had tested positive in Japan, and then 18 tested positive here with the CDC test upon their arrival. So does that suggest that they were infected en route, or might there be some other explanation?
This is CDC again. What I would say is, as we said when this started, these group of people we judged to be at high risk for COVID-19 based on what the attack rates were on the cruise ship. Therefore, it is possible that some of these people were already incubating the disease when they left Japan, and that is similar to, for example, what we've seen in just some of the travelers in the U.S. I'll remind you that some of the U.S. cases were asymptomatic when they came back in the U.S. and then developed symptoms several days later. So it's entirely possible that that's what's going on here. I think that more information will become available over the next couple of days as we fully evaluate these repatriated travelers and as we line up the lab results from Japan as well as the testing in the United States. So more than that, I think it's pretty premature to say. Next question.
Wait. Actually, for state, just one clarification to that. The positive results that you saw in folks that were repatriated either before they were transported, becoming positive, or immediately upon arrival, it's important to note that those test samples were obtained 48 to 72 hours prior to the evacuation or repatriation flight. And so the results that you're seeing don't represent infection en route. They actually represent infection that existed prior to the evacuation that is only now coming to light.
And our next question is from Lenny Bernstein with the Washington Post. Your line is open.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Dr. Messonnier, you say that you expect to see more infections from Diamond Princess passengers. Is that based on preliminary testing? Is that just a prediction? And if you can say how many more, is this going to be a very large number?
Yes, as I think you know, if you've been listening to me give these telebriefings for weeks, you know, I'm never going to make predictions that way. But I guess what we would say is that this was a high-risk situation. Based on what we know about the attack rates and the exposures, we should expect to see additional cases. Some of these passengers are still in what we would consider the incubation period, which we know to be 10 to 14 days. And until we're through that period, we won't have a good feel for how many additional cases there are, but we do think, based on epidemiology and risk assessment, that there may be additional cases. Next question.
Our next question is from Luke Simmons from KENS 5 San Antonio. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering if you could clarify on the group that is over at Lackland. Is that two more patients that have tested positive, not including the one that had originally come here? And then also, we had some elected officials that were concerned with them being taken, you know, for testing at the local hospitals, and it seems like you may have changed course a little bit with the Texas Center for Infectious Disease. I'm just wondering if you can kind of clarify what that process is once you guys, you know, start testing in this type of incident.
I'm going to maybe answer the second question first. So as we said, with these repatriated groups, our assessment of the groups in terms of their risk drives our stance in terms of what kind of testing we do. And so because these returning because these repatriated individuals were judged to be at high risk, we have done additional testing on them, and it is right. But in addition to that testing, we also are continuing to do surveillance for illness, which is clearly our focus, identifying people that are ill and making sure that they are getting appropriate treatment so that they don't have poor outcomes. When somebody is identified as being ill, those are the folks that are being hospitalized, if that's what you're asking me. So there are people who are in quarantine. There are people who are in local hospitals because they're getting care.
Is that what you're asking me?
Yes. Well, and also just it seems like, you know, some of the elected officials were concerned about the testing itself, making sure that that was happening at Lackland. They didn't necessarily need to go to a hospital at that point. And then can you also talk about the Texas Center for Infectious Disease? Is that where you plan to take these people now that are testing positive and not just local hospitals, you know, with the general population?
So I would say that we probably need to defer back to DOD for this, but that in every situation we're trying to make the best decision possible for the health of these individual patients. And in each of these bases and in each of these situations, the individual patient-level decisions end up being a little bit different as we make those decisions with the health department and with the DOD folks that have been kind enough to let us keep their patients, let us keep the passengers on these bases. Our focus is in the individuals, again, making sure that they're getting the care possible. But also, we want to make sure that the rest of their communities, as well as the folks on the DOD bases, also are assured of their own safety. And so working those issues together, each individualized situation ends up being a little different. Next question.
Our next question is from John Woolfolk with Bay Area News Group. Your line is open.
Thank you, Doctor. I got to ask you to go over the numbers of infections, both from the previous cases and the Diamond Princess. You talk awful fast, and if you could clarify, have you subtracted from the total The two that we know of that have been declared recovered, or is that still being counted in? Is this new case out of Humboldt County in California being added to that? If you could just go over the numbers of who is infected, that would be a big help.
Yeah, and I am sorry for going through those quickly. What I would start by saying is that the number should be up on the CDC website within the hour because it is a little complicated to work through the details. Let me start by saying that if you're a case, you remain a case. Even if you recover, you were still a case. And so we're not subtracting cases. The patient from Humboldt County who was announced overnight should be added into those numbers. But if, for example, somebody was identified as being a confirmed case this afternoon, that number won't be posted until Wednesday. So that's the distinction. You know, we pick a time to post our numbers. It's Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. We are separating out the folks that are repatriated because we think they really do are a separate category and that it doesn't reflect transmission and risk in general in the U.S. And so what you'll see us separating is the U.S. cases versus the cases among repatriated individuals, and those are in two groups. The first set of repatriated individuals are those folks who came back from Wuhan on the repatriated flights. There are three patients that are confirmed COVID-19 associated with their flight, those flights. And then there are the repatriated folks from the Diamond Princess. That also will be a separate category. So far, that number is 18. But we are still trying to adjudicate the Japanese results as well. And so we likely will be including in that number eventually patients that were confirmed in Japan. But we'll really try to make sure on our website to post those numbers differently. So bottom line is there's one new U.S. case since our last briefing, which was a week ago. And then there is a separate category of folks that were on the Diamond Princess, and we will continue to keep those numbers separately. And please do, within the hour, those will be on the website, and hopefully it'll make it much clearer. Next question.
Our next question is from Julie Steenhuisen from Reuters. Your line is open.
I have a couple questions. First of all, can you tell us how many states have testing capacity? We're hearing that only three states at the moment are capable of testing for the coronavirus because of issues with the test kits. And secondly, you touched on this, at what point does it make sense to still screen passengers at airports, given how many countries now are seeing widespread or seeing additional cases and starting to, you know, at what point do you shift to community-based measures to control this virus? And thirdly, where do we stand in our understanding of whether this virus is spread in asymptomatic patients? Thank you.
So I have to say that I thought that this was one question plus one follow-up, but I will try.
I know. Sorry.
Okay. So in terms of the test kits, you know, I think we've been as transparent as one could be about this issue. I'm happy to report that we're fully stood up at CDC. There is no lag time for testing. And at this point, that is the focus of testing in the United States, the testing here at CDC, and we've had no issues at all in terms of the quality of that. As we've pushed tests out to the states, they did what we would expect as part of their normal procedures, which is do the verification in their own laboratories, and there were problems identified with the test kits. That is a normal part, unfortunately, of these processes. And we obviously would not want to use anything but the most perfect possible kits since we're making determinations about whether people have COVID-19 or not. So that is still where we are. We are working with FDA, who is the one that have oversight over us under this EUA, on redoing of some of the reagents in those kits. And we still consider it a priority to get those kits out closer to patients as soon as possible, but it is overridden by the priority to make sure that the test is correct. The second question is about screening. And I guess what I would say in general is that if you look at global data,
the focus still of most of the cases is in China and specifically in Wuhan, and that is why the layered approach that the U.S. government has put in place has focused on those places at higher risk. But we continue to reevaluate this. Screening at the airport is two different things. There is routine screening for any passenger coming back with CDC works with CBP on, and it's screening for ill people returning from overseas. That's routine. That is ongoing. That is not driven by these countries separately. We do have focused efforts focused on people returning from China, but we continue to look at those efforts to make sure that the focus is appropriate given where the burden of disease is and given where transmission is. We still think that as of today, that is the right focus. But it's also important for you to realize that that's not all we're doing. And so in addition to what's going on at the airports, we have clinicians all over the country on the lookout for patients, and we have patients who are traveling getting information from us as to potential risks so that they can be part of this of the important work of identifying cases in the U.S. We also haven't – this is not a turn-on, turn-off way of approach. That is, we're also doing community surveillance. And the reason that we've moved quickly to stand up community surveillance is with the understanding that we want to make sure that we also have other ways outside of just travel-associated screening to look for cases in the U.S. That is starting at a few sites, but we're rapidly working to make that all over the United States. And it'll be community-level surveillance for patients ill with respiratory diseases so that we can also look at a community level, both to make sure that our screening is still focused appropriately and also with the understanding that there is still the possibility in the future that this is going to spread. The final question is asymptomatic disease. I mean, there is certainly more data coming out that suggests that there are people who are reportedly asymptomatic who have this virus on OP or NP swab. We need to fully understand what that means in those individual patients. Are those patients, for example, that are being caught early that may eventually go on to get disease? How hard are folks looking to ask them for symptoms? Because in other similar illnesses, we have found that if you dig deeper, you actually find that many of these patients can recall some kind of mild symptoms. So I don't think there's anything especially new about our posture on this. We are still gathering information, and when it is enough information to impact how we operationalize, we obviously will make sure that all our partners as well as the public knows it. Next question.
We have time for two more questions.
And our next question is from Dan Vergano with BuzzFeed News. Your line is open.
Thanks. I wanted to ask the State Department official about some of the reports that there might be a spread or outbreak in Iran and whether our status with them, U.N. sanctions, would prevent us from aiding that country or any other with U.N. sanctions in the case of stopping an outbreak if they need medical help. And as a follow-up, I just wanted to clarify, was there any disagreement between CDC and State Department over returning patients who had been diagnosed in Japan from the cruise ship to the U.S.? Was that an area of disagreement between these two agencies? Thanks very much.
State Department, if you want, this is CDC. I'll take the issue of what the reports are out of Iran in terms of cases, and you answer the second question. So, you know, as folks know, at CDC, we look carefully at both formal reports from other countries as well as rumors. There have been emerging reports informally of additional cases in Iran, but some of that isn't confirmed yet, and I expect this will be something that we are looking at and talking about over the next couple days, but it's a little premature right now because really that data is really new as of today, and we need some time to evaluate it. I would also say that this is something we're obviously working closely with the World Health Organization on. State Department, I'll leave the next question to you.
This is Dr. Walters from the State Department. With regard to decision-making during the evacuation, it's important to remember that this was an emerging and unusual circumstance. We had 328 people on buses. We had a plan. We were executing the plan. And then we received lab results on otherwise asymptomatic, unill people that were on their way to an airport. I think the folks on the ground did just the right thing by out of an abundance of caution moving those 14 people into an isolation area where they pose no threat to themselves or anyone else, to provide room for a robust interagency discussion between not just CDC and state, but really the operational elements of HHS, which were from the Assistant Secretary of Preparedness and Response. At the end of the day, the State Department had a decision to make informed by our interagency partners, and we went ahead and made that decision, and the decision, I think, was the right one in bringing those people home.
This is CDC. Maybe I'll just add that, these are difficult decisions that we're faced with every day, and we're making those decisions in real time. And when you make those kind of complicated decisions, there are going to be different perspectives that are brought to the table. But we are one U.S. government working together, and we will continue to operate under that stance as we have forever since it started and as we will into the future. Our focus is on, right now, the forward-looking health of these repatriated citizens and to continue to manage the response seamlessly within the government. Next question.
And our next question is from Andrew Joseph with STAT. Your line is open.
Hi. Following up on some of the testing questions, has testing started through the influenza network yet? And also, you mentioned, you know, how clinicians are on the lookout for patients. But have you all thought about broadening the recommendation? Because as it stands now, I think online it's either fever and, or sorry, symptoms and either travel history to Wuhan or contact with a confirmed case or a person under investigation. And just as you've mentioned, it seems to be spreading pretty efficiently outside Wuhan. So have you thought about expanding that evaluation guideline? Thank you.
In terms of the first question, as folks may remember, the first place that we're starting with expanded surveillance is syndromic surveillance, which we're already doing. The second certainly is the focus on returning travelers, which, again, we're already doing. The next piece of that was to expand our influenza surveillance to allow us to look at patients that are being detected, because it's the clinical syndrome is the same, and then patients that are identified as not having flu to at the public health laboratories test them for COVID-19. We are just in the process of standing that up in the first 6 sites, and I hope that that will be online by next week. That is certainly our plan. I like to under-promise and over-deliver, but we certainly, if everything goes as it is, we expect that to be on track for next week. In terms of our case definition, you may know that on our webpage, we do go through in detail our current case definition, and the current case definition does say that patients that have fever, symptoms of lower respiratory infection requiring hospitalization, and a history of travel from mainland China meet the case definition for testing. We are regularly looking at the epidemiological situation globally, and then with our state and local health department partners, evaluating our case definition to make sure that it is still sensitive and specific enough. We will continue to do that, including conversations today on this issue, and we are certainly sensitive to the question of when and if this starts spreading more broadly in communities globally, how that impacts how we define a patient under investigation here in the U.S. So we want to make sure that we're targeting our efforts appropriately. We also obviously don't want to miss transmission in the United States, and so balancing those things going forward, we are going to continue to look at travel history and see when and if there's the right reasons to expand that behind China.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Messonnier, and thank you all for joining us today for today's briefing. Please check CDC's 2019 COVID-19 website for the latest updates on CDC's response efforts. If you have further questions, please call CDC's media line, 404-639-3286, email media@cdc.gov. Thank you.
And this concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time.